Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Ham Nation is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode is brought to you by ICOM. For more information, please visit ICOMAmerica.com/HamNation. This is Ham Nation, episode number 107, July 24th, 2013. We're going to mix some Raspberry Pi and audio. Hello, everybody. This is K9EID, and you're watching Ham Nation. It's a program all about amateur radio, having fun, and having more fun. We got a big lineup tonight of things to do. You're going to learn a lot of things. And first of all, let's go down to Costa Mesa. Gordo, how are you doing?
I am doing great, and this is exciting because take a listen. On the ICOM 9100 with just a marginal antenna, right now to demonstrate the Hawaiian beacon is pounding in on 2 meters as well as peaking in on 432. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Bob, back to you.
It's still happening, huh? That's really great. Super duper. George, what do you got going on tonight?
Well, I had a little problem getting my Raspberry Pi TNC configured. The device itself is fine. The kit worked great. I just had a little problem downloading the software. I've got that solved now, but I didn't have it in time for this week. So I've got a special little video here tonight on how to set up your Raspberry Pi from an out-of-the-box experience.
Okay, cool. Well, I got a little bit of a request for you. Can you see what's sitting behind me right back there? I should have turned it on maybe.
Yeah, the scope. That?
Uh-huh. And I just want you to know I have one of these things. I think you know what to do with one of these things called a soldering iron. It's cold, by the way. And I have a whole bunch of these things, you know, like coax connectors. And yeah. Somewhere I had my box here. I have a little box. And my request to you is to tell me and all of our vast audience how to hook that up to one of those transceivers so I can make sure my signal's good. Think you can do that?
I think we can do that, Bob. Coming up right away, though, I'm going to be using one of these things. That's a desoldering station I just bought. You can see I've got a HF rig laid over back here that's got a bad receiver, so I've got to do a little work on that so I can get back on the air.
Well, I've had a lot of requests, and I know you have too, about help us hook up a scope. So in coming shows, stay tuned, everybody. In a few weeks, maybe we can have you help us with this how to make your scope work. And later on in the show, we're going to revisit more in depth of how to hook up your transceiver to a mixer and some speakers and make things sound better and receive. I even am going a little further tonight, too, to hook up the microphone. So that's all coming down the line. First, we're going back to Gordo because he's got some really great stuff. So, Gordo, it is all yours.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Great to see you, George. And, boy, it was fun visiting with Leo. Well, it's an exciting day for all of the West Coast of the United States because Fred, King Henry VII, Yankee, has got the beacon up, and it's coming in loud and clear, 2,500 miles from the California Pacific Amateur Radio Club site high above the Mauna Loa volcano. So this is neat, and we're going to take a look tonight a little bit more about tropospheric ducting, as well as hoping to break the record this year on 10,000 megahertz. And we're going to give a little training for Brian. Brian is our main digital guy. And Brian up at the studio has been working with Jason, W6AUX, Dave, W6DBE, and Susie, N6GLF, and making sure the short shots come through loud and clear. So, Brian, let's go ahead and roll them. And here's your CW message for first slide. Now, if you take a look, that is Catalina Island. And I want you to look, everyone, at the dip. That is the isthmus, two harbors, they call it, the birds above the dip. And you're going to see that dip take a very strange look in just a few more moments. We're going to be, as the band conditions are changing on the 2 meter band, getting ready for 10,000 megahertz. Now, 10,000 megahertz is where in August, as well as September, the American Radio Relay League has a program on 10 gigahertz, 10,000 megahertz. And it's a contest that lasts for 2 days in Ham's Head for the high hills. Now, to get on 10,000 megahertz, you need that green box called a transverter that's going to take 10,000 megahertz and transform it down to 2 meters. Or on transmit, it's going to take about a couple milliwatts of 2 meters and transform it up to about 10 watts on 10,000 megahertz. And that's the front of the transceiver. You see the 2 meter radio, and we roll this into a dish antenna. And the dish antenna, you'll see, is called a Cassegrain feed. It's a splash feed that beams all of the energy reflected off the main dish onto that little tiny nose, and then that pulls it down via waveguide. And some of the ranges that we're able to get at 10,000 megahertz, anywhere from 300 to 500 miles. In fact, ZL4 Papalima Mike is sending over to Hawaii a 10-watt, 10-gigahertz beacon package shortly. You can see I'm pretty excited because band conditions are improving, and I just worked over 350 miles on 10,000 megahertz. That's called the X band. I'm working with the San Bernardino Microwave Society, and SBMS has a great website at SBMS at ham-radio.com, and they are the local Southern California gurus of microwave experts. Yes, speed checked by radar, the speed of radio waves. And the speed checked by radar is a fun sign because our communications operate just above the marine radio band on 10,000 megahertz. Now, we're looking for conditions that's going to give our 10,000 megahertz signal the long-range capability. And one of the best reports, and we had many emails about this last week, was where do we get that? And it's called InfoCenter, and it's also called the Hepburn Report. www.dxinfocenter, and it's T-R-E. com, and you'll be able to see where some of the band openings are taking place. And you'll notice Southern California all the way up to Canada goes all the way out to Hawaii in orange and reds, and that's good. And we're going to use our down east microwave transverter to get our signal over to, well, can't quite make Hawaii, but up and down the coastline. And transverters are available from down east microwave, Kuhn Electronics, SSB Electronics, and the best way to look up for more on 10 gigahertz transceivers where you used to do a little bit of plumbing to get them to work with your 2 meter radio is W1GHZ.org. Well, 10 gigahertz out on the water does some fun things. And here we are taking the dish antenna that you'll see in a few moments behind me, ready for a boat ride. And as we get it ready for the boat ride, you'll see that everything is relatively portable. The rig is in a little black bag that's ready to go aboard. And one thing we found out was that you do not have to necessarily have the antenna absolutely level for 10,000 megahertz out on the water because the water acts like a perfect reflector. And that is my way of leveling the dish antenna, and that's with a little plumb bob on the bottom. Well, once we get out there on the water, we're going to need a compass right there so we know which way to aim. But, you know, out on the water, we could be 5 or 10 degrees up or down or port or starboard, left or right, and we still have a great signal on 10,000 megahertz. Here we are out on the sailboat, and we're making the first contact. The dish looks pointed up a little bit, but as we're rolling around, we get out fine. And our record so far is 400 miles running 1 watt of power with a jack and 6XQ several years ago when we were up in the LA area and he was way down in Baja California on 10,000 megahertz. Now, 10,000 megahertz is a fun band, and it's not hard to get on there. And again, go to W1GHZ.org and then look at the many different transverters. That's the green box from Down East Microwave, the DB6NT, as well as SSB electronics transverters. And we do our transmitting into the dish antenna, not via coax, but with either semi-rigid waveguide or, as you'll see shortly, flexible black waveguide. Because up this high, coax cable would have too much of a loss. And every year, we have, through the San Bernardino Microwave Society, a tune-up. And this coming Saturday, the tune-up is coming to town, care of the San Bernardino Microwave Society. And Dennis W6DQ is going to bring his Agilent HP spectrum analyzer. The San Diego folks are bringing up all of their test equipment. And what we do is we set up a range, and about 15 or 20 of us will check our transmitter as well as our receiving capabilities on 10,000 megahertz and higher. Here you see all of us getting lined up, and it's not so much to be a contest, but it always turns into be a contest. And we've got some folks that put out anywhere from 3 to 10 to 15 watts. You do not want to be standing in front of that dish antenna on transmit. And what we do is we squeak a signal out, and there you see the black upper right-hand corner waveguide. Once stuff comes out of the transverter at 10,000 megahertz, that's where we drop the coax cable connections and go to flexible or hard waveguide. And here's N6EQ. He's a very popular microwave operator. Very nice, neat setup. And Chuck is beaming away to see how strong his signal is. And the little ribbed item, yep, you guessed it. That's an amplifier that'll take a half a watt and kick it up to a whopping 5 watts on 10 gigs. And folks have the flexible waveguide to elbows, and everything has to be done absolutely precision because you can't move much if you're not absolutely perfectly aligned at 10,000 megahertz. So this weekend is going to be the big contest. Now, look at this. Remember that Catalina shot we showed you? Look what happened. Pastor Jason, this is your island. Look what happened to the isthmus. During tropospheric ducting conditions that are quite intense, many times we will have optical illusions. And these optical illusions are a manifestation of hot air overlying cool air and cold air above it. So you see that the isthmus is taking on a very strange shape. And a little later on, it takes on, oh my gosh, it's got a bridge going across. And this is a mirage. And the mirage is what 10,000 megahertz and VHF and UHF bands love. And yes, that is a mirage in the forming right there with the subsidence tropospheric duct. Now watch again what happens. This is a freighter whose image you can see as a reflection. That's right. That's a reflection of the freighter in the approximately 20-degree temperature difference hanging offshore. So that is a mirage that is unbelievable. But wait a minute. You're going to see a couple more that are even more unbelievable. Now look at Catalina Island. Wow, if someone had a 10-gig dish over there, they could easily get a signal over here with just microwatts of power. And now, again, look at what happened. The island doesn't really look like that, but that is the mirage, which really takes 2 meters and 432 signals and causes them to follow the curvature of that mirage for, in our case, thousands of miles here on the West Coast. So we'll wind up by saying that you never know what's going to happen out there on the 10 gigahertz bands when tropospheric ducting clicks in. So, Bob, I'm going to turn it back to you at Lab 1 because I know you've got some more excitement. And I'm going to go ahead and dial into and begin hearing a little bit more of that 10,000 megahertz beacon that you can hear in the background that's pouring in. Back to you, Bob.
That's amazing. I didn't know that, Gordo. That's just really something. I didn't know that that the island went away like that when you look at it. That's something. I'm impressed. And so we all learn right here on Ham Nation. That's wonderful. Well, we're going to come back to far from 10 gigs, that's for sure. We're going to come back down to 1,000 cycles, 100 cycles. We've been talking about this so much, and I think, okay, everybody's got it, and I just keep getting tons of emails. That's okay. Keep sending them, because there's more and more things that you can do, and what we're talking about is making your station capable of listening better. And it's all about the audio output. You buy a matching speaker, and I'm sorry, it's just more than a painted box with painted the same color. They really don't do much in them. I know. You got filters. No. You still have to rely on the little 1 watt at high distortion chip that all transceivers have. So what you do is you come out of the back, and I've got some slides here, and we're going to go through these and try to help you a little bit. First of all, use a very, very high-quality speaker. And what I use is a JBL is one of them. This is a JBL Control 2P. That's the back of it, and it has inputs. Those are really cool inputs, by the way, new connectors. You can use a 3-pin XLR, or you can use a 1/4-inch phone jack in that same plug, either one. It's got an input for RCAs and, of course, the power. But then the other 1/4-inch at the bottom, that is the output of the other amplifier to feed the second speaker. Both amplifiers are in this one. And the other speaker is just the speaker. There's no electronics in it. Now, we have to hook this up, and I want everybody to pay attention here. Go to your manual, and there'll be a page that tells you what all those pins do along the left side. It'll tell you what they're for. And what we want to find is the audio out, and that is going to be on one of the pins. And they even have pictures of how to do it. It shows you how to hook it up to a TNC. Same thing. That same output is going to feed your mixer. Then we can get to the process here. On the left, the connector is the DIN plug, and we take the other end of that is hooked into the mixer with a 1/4-inch. You don't have to go into the XLR there. On the mixer, they have an XLR input, and then they have a 1/4-inch. Now, the 1/4-inch is line level. So you want to keep that that line level, because you're coming out of the line output of the receiver. The output of the mixer is the green 1/4-inch. That's going to go into the speaker. Now, this is just when you're going to use one speaker. Simple. Okie dokie. The next one is going to be how to hook up both speakers. You will have the input. One is coming from the receiver DIN connector, as before. The output, there are two outputs, left and right, on the mixers. We're going to plug the left into one of the inputs of the amplifier, going to plug the right to the other one. And then, of course, we hook up the speaker. If you want to do a microphone and a speaker, it gets a little crazy. Same deal. We hook up the DIN plug into channel 1, and then channel 2 receives the microphone. Now, here's where it gets tricky. The left output of the mixer goes into the speaker. The right output goes out of the right side into another DIN plug, and that DIN plug plugs into the audio on the other pin of the accessory jack. You got an in and an out. And the output of that DIN plug is going to plug into the input of the mixer. The output of the mixer is going to plug to the in of your transceiver. And that's how you would connect it. But here's the important part. Channel 1, which is your receiver, is panned all the way to the left. That's a pan pot. That moves it from center to left to right. So that pan pot's going to be hard left. That's your volume control of your receiver. The microphone channel that you have your microphone plugged in is going to pan hard right, and that will come out of the right side into the DIN plug, which is, of course, the input to your radio. And therefore, they don't see each other. The mixer is doing two totally different things, and they never mix together. That's beautiful about all these great mixers that are dual channel. And what you want to do is just pay attention to how this all happens. We'll review this again. The black cable you see is from the DIN plug. That's your audio out. That comes into channel 1. Pan it hard left. And then the left output, as you see in that picture, the left output, the black cable, is feeding the speaker, where the right output is feeding the input to your DIN plug. And that's how you can get one mixer to do two things. And it just is really gorgeous to be able to do that. I recommend everybody do this in steps. Get the speaker going first. Get it all hooked up and working. And don't go hurrying to hook the microphone into it yet. Take your time and get familiar with that mixer. It's so important that you understand how it works, and you'll understand. And we didn't get into the equalization. You are the engineer of your amateur radio station. So you are the one that's going to listen in another receiver while you transmit to adjust the transmit side. For the receive side, it's wonderful. I'm going to try next week to have some recordings and show you what happens. Here I can show you a little bit of what happens in my station. All of the transceivers you see behind me have no speakers hooked to them. All of the volume controls are hooked up or as a stationary at the level. I never touch the receivers. This is my receiver volume. This is for one of them, this guy. This one is for that guy. This is for the 7600 that you just heard this come from. That's here. That's the volume for that transceiver's receiver, the wonderful old 870 and the 480. Each one of the transceiver's outputs come into this mixer, and then the output feeds my JBL speakers. And there are many others. Oh, man, I always hasten to tell you about JBL because I love them so much. But there's a lot of powered speakers. Not computer speakers. We're talking about monitor speakers for real-time high-dollar studios. Are they expensive? No. A couple of $100. Some of them will get, you can go spend $20,000 for them, but we're not talking that. We're talking about what we call near-field monitors. And there's a lot of companies that build different powered speakers with 20, 30, 40 watts. It's great. You don't need that much power. But when you do that, you have very low distortion. Those amplifiers are very low in distortion. So I hope this helps you. And please let me hear from you. I'm ripping out of here first thing tomorrow, heading down to Oklahoma to the Ham Holiday, Ham Fest. I'm excited about that. And I hope to get back here late Sunday, and I'll try to get some more stuff done for next week. But there's another chapter, and I hope I don't bore you with some of this. But, boy, I'm getting so many requests from everybody. Keep them coming. Keep them coming. And we're going to now see some more shacks that's got a lot of things going on, I bet you. And Dale, how are you doing on all of your video things? Things looking good this week?
Looks like you're muted, Dale.
There you go. Hey, we're doing great here. Been collecting those QSL cards from the 13 colonies. Have 9 of the 13 already, plus I've got the card from the William Penn Station. And over the weekend, we were busy with the Ham Nation cards. Esther and I mailed out 136 cards over the weekend. Wow. And we've got more to go. If you'd like a card, just send that self-addressed stamped envelope to the 4 special event Ham Nation stations, and we'll all be glad to help you out there. So let's jump into the videos. First one is a Show Me Your Mobile Shack, and it comes from Dan, N9LVS. Let's go ahead and roll it, Brian.
The N9LVS mobile operation, where I run 1,200 watts on HF. The key to the entire operation is this dual-wound 24-volt aircraft alternator, which we run in series, so we end up with 48 volts on the output, which does require the use of 2 serpentine belts. We run the Kenwood V7A for VHF and UHF operation, and the Yaesu 857D for HF. The amplifier is the ALS-1300, which is connected to the ALS-500RC to give us the 1,200 watts on HF. The two Larson 270s are for 2 meters and 440 operation, and the Diamond CR670 is for 6 meters, 2 meters, and 70 centimeters. The HF antenna is a homebrewed antenna. I've always used homebrewed antennas for HF mobile. It consists of aluminum cast driven into a PVC pipe, a 102-inch whip, and a Silver Bullet 1000 from Wolf River Coils. The coil is made here locally and is made out of all stainless steel, which means it'll hold up to the harsh Wisconsin winters. Grounding is very important on an HF mobile operation. In my case, I'm connected to the trailer hitch, then to a piece of pipe that comes out the side and goes up to the PVC. The big problem I have running HF mobile at 1,200 watts is I keep burning the tips off the 102-inch whips, but they do create a pretty good corona ball when you get just the right conditions.
Whoa.
And that's the N9LVS mobile operation. Hope you enjoyed the tour.
Okay, Dan, thanks. How do you like that corona? I remember creating some corona with a Swan 240 back in the early 60s. That was in a Volkswagen Bug. That was a lot of fun, too. So, Dan, thanks a lot. Dan maintains the wiki for Ham Nation at twit.tv. Does that work every week, and I'm working with him now. We're going to put up a site dedicated to Ham Nation videos. I've got the domain purchased, and I have the hosting service in place, and we hope to feature links directly to all the Ham Nation videos we broadcast, as well as videos that we've been unable to broadcast, and a whole lot more. And we'll pass along more details in the near future as we bring that on the air. Let's move to photos now, and our first photo comes from Brazil, from Cassio Fonte Fiera, PU1UMS. He's from Rio de Janeiro, and he was visiting with Bob at Dayton. So, Brian, if we could bring up the first slide there. Cassio reports a growing Ham Nation audience in Brazil. And while he was in Dayton, Bob took the time to autograph his new book for Cassio. We'll switch from Dayton now to Field Day, Idaho style. And, well, that's not the Idaho one, but let's tell you what that is. that was sent in by, I've got to find it here, okay, I've got his name, Dennis Bartholomew. He's Alpha Foxtrot 6 Tango Romeo. He's with the Elk Grove Florin Amateur Radio Club, and he converted an exercise bike into a battery charger for Field Day using an auto alternator. Unfortunately, it didn't work. So Dennis is going back to the drawing boards and get ready for Field Day 2014. So there's some ham ingenuity. We've got a couple of more Field Day photos. If we can switch back to Idaho, we'll pick up a couple of those, or I'll just wait and see what comes up, and we will go from there. Okay, here's a here's another shot that we got in from.
I'm a fan. I love from, that.
We're going from Idaho, which we never got to yet, to Cuyahoga, just southwest of Cleveland. And that's from Tom Wayne, WB8N. And he bought this Vintage Icom 740 in 1986. We can show that in this fan photo. He said it wasn't on purpose, but he just put the fan with the sign because he had the fan leaning on it. But I don't think it was a coincidence there. Here's his rake from 1986, an Icom 740. And he was operating there with George Pindro. Should have a shot of them. He's K8KR. And that about wraps up that. Brian, bring the next slide up, and we will go to it. Now we're going to Idaho. And these shots came in from K7JAN. And that's the business end of his FT897D. He has the LDG tuner. But the real picture is a beauty. Jeep Mobile in the mountains with a 32-foot pull-up with 32 feet of wire fed with a 9-to-1 Unan for stationary ops. And Jim's sidekick for that field day experience was Larry. He's K7BUY. That about wraps it up for the – well, we've got some Boy Scout photos here from Michael Bresham. They were out last week operating a Boy Scout station K2BSA.
All right.
The boys in the picture are Ryan, Scott, and Noah. They're from Troop 564 in Wisconsin. They're working on their radio merit badge at the station there. The three scouts, two of them are Michael's sons, plan to take their license exam real soon now in the near future. And Michael said that by watching Ham Nation and using Gordo's book, he was able to earn his own technician class license. He didn't send that call sign to me yet, so we'll see what we can find out. That does wrap up the photos for this evening. We wanted to get those in. You guys have been nice enough to send them in. And we'll wrap it up here with a really nice feature from Neil Masters Gutierrez. He's KK6BKU. And he features the Night of Nights, and that's at the Maritime Radio Station, KPH. Let's watch.
The historic station, KPH. During its operational period, it served as a communication link to ships abroad. However, in 1999, on July 12th, commercial Morse code operation ended. As such, every year on that same day at 5 p.m., the Maritime Radio Historical Society takes the station on air to commemorate the legacy of Morse code and its radio telegraph operators in an event known as Night of Nights. Unlike many of its counterparts, it has been spared the meeting with the bulldozer because of its unique location in the Point Reyes National Seashore on the Pacific Coast just north of San Francisco. As such, the entire building, its antennas, and transmitters has been left as they were on its final day, including messages still in the teleprinters and punch tapes hanging. The system operates as a pair, with operations and events run at the control point of the Point Reyes receive station. From here, operators remotely key the transmitters located about 18 miles south in the town of Bolinas. These stations were designed like this because each of the original Henry and RCA high-frequency and medium-frequency transmitters are capable of 3 to 4 kilowatts of output power each. In addition to this special annual event, the Maritime Radio Historical Society runs an amateur station, K6KPH, which is operated every Saturday from around 1700 to 2300 UTC. Visit the official website at radiomarine.org for much more information.
Thanks a lot, Neil, for that look at a very historic radio station. Next week, you won't want to miss it. Scott, the 9-year-old amateur from last week, he'll be back, and he'll be in CUSO with Randy, K7AGE. Don't want to miss that one. Don't forget to send your Ham Nation videos to hamnationvideos@twit.tv. Thanks, and 7-3 from the Yellow Brick Road. Now it's time for Newsline, and here's Don.
From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 1875, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. Researchers say that this year's solar maximum is shaping up to be the weakest in some 100 years, and the next one could be even quieter. About every 11 years, the sun goes through a cycle defined by an increasing and then decreasing number of sunspots. The current cycle, known as Solar Cycle 24, has been underway since 2011. Its peak was expected this year, but there have been fewer sunspots observed compared with the maximums of the last several cycles. Scientists seem to agree that a small cycle 24 also fits within a 100-year pattern of building and waning solar cycles. They say they don't know yet the exact cause of the trend, but they note that there were weak solar cycles in the beginning of the 19th and 20th centuries as well as now in the 21st. For ham radio, this means that while various bands are far from dead, their full potential may not come about during this solar cycle. Amateur radio has been granted an exemption from a new West Virginia law that bans most distractions while operating a motor vehicle in that state. Jim Davis, W2JKD.
The new distracted driving law took effect on Monday, July the 1st. Under its terms, it's no longer legal to text and or drive, nor use a cellular telephone that's not operated hands-free. But amateur radio operators are still allowed to operate their two-way radio gear while behind the wheel, as long as they're properly licensed by the FCC. Also for ham radio operators, portable radio devices such as handhelds are not considered distracted driving implements under the new law.
Emergency officials like police, fire, and emergency management services are also exempt and will continue to be allowed to use radios while driving. Last week, Gordon showed us the VHF beacon from Hawaii to California. Now word of a new 2-meter beacon from Australia to South Africa. Again, Jim Davis.
A new 2-meter special service beacon on 144.950 megahertz is being established in Perth, Western Australia. This by the Northern Corridor Radio Group in an attempt to prove that a Perth to South African path actually exists. The beacon call will be VK6RIO. The beacon will run 100 watts into 4 8-element Yagis directed towards South Africa. It'll use digital chirp modulation, which can be detected some 50 decibels below the noise floor with a 2 kilohertz bandwidth. With the processing gain from using chirp modulation, the effective radiated power is close to 100 megawatts.
And finally this week, for you smoke and solder and Raspberry Pi fans, a software-defined radio costing only $40 is the subject of an IEEE article that describes how, with some cheap hardware and free software, you can listen in on digital and analog signals across a wide range of radio spectrum. The author is Stephen Cass, KB1WNR. He used a Freeview P250 dongle, an indoor TV antenna, and a Model B Raspberry Pi microcontroller to make it all happen. You'll find links to the article and video in the printed edition of this week's Amateur Radio Newsline report. And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news, brought to you each and every week for 35 years and counting at www.arnewsline.org. I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation.
You might remember our quick teaser on ICOM's IC7100 back in January. And perhaps you caught a glimpse of it at Dayton this year. But just in case you missed it, let me tell you a little bit about this multi-band, all-mode mobile radio, ICOM 7100, HF, VHF, UHF, right at your fingertips. What sets the 7100 apart from other radios? First, it's got an intuitive touchscreen interface for easy operation. The innovative interface provides quick and smooth operation for setting and editing various functions and memories. ICOM's smart memory system gives you instant access to context and mode menu items. The newly designed radio control head features a large multifunction touchscreen dot matrix LCD display that is positioned for easy viewing and operation. The speaker is built right into the head, so you get loud and clear audio where you want it. The microphone, headphone, and external speaker jacks are located there as well. The controller is compact in size, making it ideal for limited vehicle or desktop space. The IC7100 fully covers the HF 6-meter, 2-meter, and 43440 MHz amateur bands in multiple modes, providing 100 watts on HF and 6 meters, 50 watts on VHF, and 35 watts on UHF. A high-performance 32-bit floating-point IF DSP delivers rich digital signal processing features, including digital IF filter, digital twin passband tuning, noise reduction, CW auto-tune, and more. Those digital features work on all bands, from HF to VHF UHF. The IC7100 provides D-Star DV mode digital voice and low-speed data communications, and with the near repeater function, you can add an external third-party GPS and search the internet database based on your location. And there's a built-in SD card slot for voice and log storage.
Go to icomamerica.com/hamnation for a lot more information on that, including a video that that George Thomas, W5JDX, and Ray Novak and Tommy Martin shot to tell you all about.
Reverse.
There it is right there. You're seeing it right there. Pretty amazing video. You need to go check that out. And also, while you're there, don't forget to check out the details on the ICOM Monthly Grand Prize Drawing. You can win, of course, T-shirts and hats and other stuff. But there's a free ICOM radio every month, a different one. Go to icomamerica.com/hamnation for all the official rules. Check out all of the previous drawing winners, and hopefully we'll see your name there soon.
Today, I'm going to show you from ground zero how to get your Raspberry Pi up and running. This is a neat little $35 Linux computer, and it's going to be a lot of fun. The first thing we need to do is find an SD card for the unit, because some SD cards won't work with it. Fortunately, there's an online resource at elinux.org. So we'll go to that website, and then we'll do a search for Raspberry Pi SD card. Once we get there, we'll scroll down until we find RPI Verified Peripherals. Click that link. On the right-hand side, we'll scroll down and look for SD cards. And here we'll find a listing of all the working SD cards and those known not to work. I printed out this list and took it with me to the store, so I had an easy time finding a SanDisk 32-gigabyte card that would work. I plugged the card into my ancient SD card reader, and unfortunately, it just wasn't fast enough to read these new cards. So it was back to Best Buy, where I picked up a cheap Dynex card reader, and it worked just fine. So back to a nearby web browser, and now we go to the RaspberryPi.org website. Once we get there, we click on Download to go to the Downloads page. Then we'll scroll down. I'm using Windows, so I'll look for the Win32 Disk Imager. I'll click that link, and it'll take me to Softpedia where I can download it. But you need to be careful here, because there's all kinds of crap they throw on there that tries to make it look like it's a download link, and in fact, it's not. So look carefully until you found the download link. Now, if it wants to install some kind of download manager for you, don't do it. Just go back and keep looking around, and you'll eventually find the link where you can actually download the file. Now we go back to the RaspberryPi.org downloads page and look for our Linux distribution. There are several on here to choose from, but the one that's probably the newest and I've heard the most about is the Raspbian Wheezy distribution. So that's the one I'm going to get. Now, there's two methods here to download. You can choose a torrent, which is what they recommend, or you can do a direct download. I'm going to do a direct download here just to show you that, since I don't have a torrent client installed. Now, this is going to take several minutes to download, so you may want to take a break and grab a snack.
Popcorn freshly popped and buttered. Look good? Sure, it looks good, and it tastes even better. Get some now.
Now back to the downloads page, and we notice a checksum here. That's a number we'll use to verify that we got a good download. We'll click here for the instructions, and if we're running Linux, here's the instructions for checking it there. However, we're running Windows, so we need to download sha1sum.exe so that we can verify our image. Now that we've downloaded all the files we need, we've got our Linux distribution, we've got the SHA-1-SUM program, which will be used to verify the image is good, and we also have the Win32 disk image program that'll be used to copy our image onto the SD card. Now we'll verify the image by using the SHA-1-SUM program. I'll need to run that from a command prompt, so I'll click the Windows Start button. In the search box, I will enter CMD for command and press Enter, and it pops up a command window. The first thing we will need to do is change directories to the folder where our image is stored. Now we'll run the SHA1SUM program by typing that in on the command line, followed by a space, and then the name of the image file, still in zip format, that we want to verify. Now I'm going to copy the name here using Control-C, and then I'll come down here and paste it in the command window, since it is a long name. And you'll have to put the .zip extension at the end of it, since it's not already there. Now there's the checksum for the file, so we'll bring back up our browser window, which shows the proper checksum, and then we'll compare these two numbers. And they're quite long, but we'll find that they do match, so we know we've got a good, valid file download. Now we need to unzip the image file and store it somewhere, and unzip the Win32 disk image program, and I just stuck it in a temporary folder here. I'll run that program. The first thing I'll do is click the icon here to choose my image file, and we're on the desktop, and there's the image. And the next thing I need to do is to choose the drive that it goes on, and that is the G drive. I had verified that earlier. This is our SD card. And then it's just a matter of clicking right and waiting for the image to be transferred to the SD card. Yes, we want to do it. Now, this is going to take a few moments as well. It looks like we have success, so it's time to leave the PC and move over to the bench with the Raspberry Pi. The Raspberry Pi comes with a quick start guide, and we'll look over that and see what we need to do here. We've already got our SD card prepared, so we're ready to move on and connect things. Now we'll need a 5-volt power supply that can do at least 700 milliamps. I hear it's better to have more than that. I have a supply that I plan to use, but for now I'm just going to use the supply off my iPad. It says that it's 5 volts at 2.1 amps, so that should be plenty. The power supply connects with a micro USB cable, and I've got one of those. Just plugs in the end here. And the instructions say we need to connect everything before we power up. So we've got our keyboard, which is USB. We'll plug that in. And we'll plug in a USB mouse. Next, we need to plug in our video, which I'm going to use HDMI to go to a 720p HDMI monitor that I use here in the studio. And then we'll put in our SD card, which will act as a hard drive. It plugs in this little connector here on the bottom of the board. And there's one final connector to install, and that's our Ethernet cable. Now we should be ready to power up. Power on, and immediately we start getting some prompts on the screen as the Raspberry Pi configures the operating system. Eventually, we come to a setup screen. The first thing I'm going to do is expand the root partition so that we use the whole drive. The next option is for overscan of the monitor. This one looks okay, so we're not going to adjust that. And then we have configured the keyboard layout. Well, let's take a look at that. Now I'm using the Microsoft Comfort Curve 3000 keyboard. There's a 2000 listed here, so I'll choose that. Now there are several other options here under configuring the keyboard, and we'll step through each of those one at a time and choose what looks best for us. Now after that, we're given the option to change the password, but I'm going to leave it like it is for now. And then we can set the locale. Now, I'm a little unclear as to exactly how the locale should be set here, so I'm going to leave that one alone and go down to change time zone. I'll choose America, and then I'll choose the city that's in my time zone that I see first, which is Chicago. Then we have the option to set the memory split, which I'm not going to bother with, and to enable or disable the SSH server, which I'm not going to bother with either. Then we can set the boot behavior, which I want this one to boot directly to the desktop when it starts. And the final option is to try to upgrade the Raspberry Pi config. I'm going to choose that option, and it'll take a few moments here to go through and do its upgrading process. After that, we're finished, so I'll click Finish, and it wants to reboot the system, and I'll say Yes. And after a while, it's finished doing all its configuration again, and it boots into the desktop. And there we have it, the Raspberry Pi desktop. Now, I'm not a Linux guy, so I don't understand everything I'm seeing on here, but we'll find a web browser and see if we can locate our favorite website. Looks like it worked. We'll navigate around here a little bit. Now, let's try one other thing. I'm not much of a gamer, but let's try Wormy. Well, that didn't take very long, did it? Well, there you have it, George's 10-minute Raspberry Pi recipe. Goody, that's something I did a year ago. And actually, this week, you know, I had planned on demonstrating the TNC Pi, which I've built. It does work, but I had some problems downloading some software. I've got that straight now, but not in time to get that report out this week. So I just showed this one on setting up a Raspberry Pi, since you're going to have to do that if you're going to use the Raspberry Pi TNC anyway. And judging by our contest this week, the Raspberry Pi is really popular with our audience. I had at least twice as many entries in the contest this week as I normally get, and maybe even three times. The reason is we're going to be giving away a TNC Pi, and I asked a question last week, what does TNC stand for? And I got an answer from Lou Roberts, KI6YWX, and he said the answer to the question is TNC stands for Terminal Node Controller. So congratulations, Lou. You're going to win this TNC Pi kit. We'll be getting that out to you this week. And for next week, I've got another question here. What was the first amateur radio digital mode? And if you think you know the answer to that, send me an email to hamnationcontest@gmail.com. And in our other contest we didn't mention earlier, right after the ICOM ad, is you can tune in and enter to win every week. If you go to icomamerica.com/hamnation, you can register there for the weekly swag giveaway, and you can give us a little feedback about Ham Nation. Plus, you'll be entered in the monthly radio giveaway. And this month, we've got a great one, so you certainly want to go register after the show tonight and after next week's show. Get your name in the hat, because you could win an ID 51A VHF, UHF, dual band transceiver with D-Star. It's a great little handheld. It's one you certainly want if you're getting into D-Star. It's probably the nicest one on the market. So go to icomamerica.com/hamnation and register today. And now let's bring in Cheryl with the chat room. Cheryl, how's it going tonight?
Hi there. Hi, George. How are you? W5JDX. This is K9BIK. Good to see you. You did such a great job tonight. Wonderful. And hi to Bob. He did a nice job. And Gordo, I think you deserve a big, big hello, too. What a great job on that ship. You know, we had people in the chat room tonight that asked, was that your boat? And by the way, George, I just wanted to let you know that Phil, one of our chat roomers, he said, CR7AFP, he says, George, You use Windows, not a smoke and solder operating system?
No, the smoke and solder operating system blew a fuse, so I had to back off from that. And I didn't even mention what the prize was for next week's giveaway. You want to get on this. If you wear a large size T-shirt, I've got a Heil Sound T-shirt here for you. So that's what you could win.
Nice. Very nice. Also, Phil, CR7AFP, he's from Portugal, by the way. I wanted to know, Bob, I know you're there. Can you advise the best Heil mic for the IC7100? He had that question in there. I just wanted to pick that up as long as we had his comment tonight. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah. Hi, Cheryl. And hi to everybody in the chat room tonight. Of course, the ICM, we build the ICM for ICOM. That's why we call it the ICM. Doesn't have the O. ICM works great, or any of the IC headphones work wonderful on the 7100. You'd be in good shape.
Very good. Very good. So let's move on to some other questions that I have here. this Curtis B. He does not have a call sign, but we welcome all people in our chat room. We love having you too, and maybe you'll get to pick up a call sign one day. He wanted to just mention to Dale if we could just bring a message to him, and I said I would. Can you say hello to him for me if you get a chance? He says he met him once back in the 1980s. He might remember, but, you know, it's unlikely he felt. But I have a couple of his computer books from around that time, and he wanted to just bring that into fruition tonight. So I just thought I'd bring that up. And also a question for Bob from NA5C. That would be Steve. He says, I listened to the headphone out on my EQ fed from an ACC Y jack on radio. I'm not sure if that's the right spelling. I think you meant jack. Accessory jack on radio sounds great. Problem is CW side tone is not fed into the ACC Y jack. I then have to connect headphones to radio to operate CW. Any suggestions? Bob?
No, you don't. You don't need to equalize the CW because you should already be in a very narrow filter of 500 or less cycles. So no, that's kind of silly. You just use a headphone jack on the receiver and it'll work great, and you'll be in good shape.
Very good, very good. And another one that we have tonight from Greg AB8RG. He wanted to know about an IEEE article online. What is the link? And I'm not sure. I might have missed that one. Who was talking about the IEEE article? Does anyone want to take that?
I don't know of any article that I was talking about. George, you got anything on that?
No, I don't.
Okay. All right. Well, I thought it might have been something I may have missed or something. But here's one for George from N5RIV from Tom. He says, does the touchscreen on the IC7100 by ICOM work while wearing gloves? Would you happen to know that?
I don't happen to know that because I wasn't wearing gloves when we tested that one out. I think it depends on if it's a resistive or a capacitive touchscreen. And I was looking to see if Ray says, yes, it does. So, yes, it will work with gloves.
Whoa.
Wow. That's pretty, pretty impressive. Very nice. Good. Well, there you go. I don't like to miss any of you guys in the chat room. It means a lot to me when you ask me things, and I try to get everything. Also, one question I have that was held over, I don't like to miss these, KD0VQT, when we were short on time. His name is George also. He says, please ask the guys how to rate a Variac 5 amps, comma, or 10 amps. George, would you care to comment on that, please?
I'm not sure what the question was. How to rate one?
Right. How to rate a Variac. And I'm not sure what he's asking by that word rate, but it sounded like something you may have talked about in an earlier program.
Well, it's either 5 amps or 10 amps, whatever it's listed as, and you can multiply that by the voltage, and that'll give you the volt amps, but I'm not sure how to answer it other than that. Bob, do you know?
No, it'll have a rating on it as how much current it will handle. That's the important part, is how much current you going to draw from all of your equipment. That's what's important, and then you will go match that current draw to what the Variac. If you're drawing 15, 18, 20 amps from all your equipment, you certainly aren't going to use a 5-amp Variac. So that's the key. You got to match those.
Thank you, guys, for tackling that one. And I've got two more questions here. One is from NT9E. He's Dave. And he has a question about an antenna. So I think I'm going to ask Gordo this one. How long does a 160-meter inverted L antenna have to be? Does it require additional inductance? Gordo?
Well, it depends how much real estate you have, but you're about 300 feet, depending as to where the L is. So contact me, WB6NOA at ARRL.net. Let's take a look at your real estate, and then we'll tell you whether or not you got to shorten it with inductance.
Very good answer on that one. It's a matter of the parameters of your property is what he's saying ultimately, and he'll work with you. Thank you for that, Gordo. I especially liked your article with the tropospheric tonight and the pictures. I was so amazed to see that phantom boat. I mean, it was like a ghost ship there and everything else. It just was incredible, and I love your plumb bob and how you set up the parabolic to get it to be, you know, even or, you know, have it plumb in that sense. But that was just such an interesting article. I'll have to replay that just to catch all of it. What a very nice job and very festive shirt to go with the ship. By the way, was that your boat?
Oh, just one of the many. No, that was a pal's boat that he could sail and I could play radio. And that article is in CQ Magazine's Popular Communication. Current issue, all about tropoducting and mirages.
Oh, wow. Thank you for that. And good to see you're out on the water there. That's at the Gordo, it's its own port. He's got many ships there, I'm sure. Thank you for everything tonight, guys. And I think I'll wrap it up with that. And I just want to mention the after show QSO on 75 meters / 80 meters, however you want to look at it. It'll be on 3850 to start. If it's a little bit busy, it'll be dropping down to 3847 megahertz. Please come and check in. I always enjoy hearing from you guys. So come on down and listen to the ICOM IC7800 and that Heil sound microphone, the HM12. What a lovely piece, Bob. All right, everybody, have a great night. And I'm going to pass it back to you, Gordo. Take care.
All right, thanks, Cheryl. And great to have everybody with us, especially the chat room. Also, Amateur Television Network over my shoulder. Hi, Don, and hi, everyone that's on ATN watching us. Bob, back to you. See you all next week.
Okay, Gordon. Yeah, great show tonight. Lots of information for everybody. And I found my box, George, and I have my connectors. I should have got my Greenlee punch out here. A little homework for you to be thinking about. Greenlee punches and nibblers and coax connector, chassis mount, and oscilloscopes. You think you can put those all together, George?
Yeah, as long as I don't drill a hole in my oscilloscope, we'll be okay, Bob.
You got it. Oh, that would be a good. I'm just kicking around some ideas because we get so many requests for this oscilloscope thing, and I think it'd be great because we all have them. At least I do. If you're running any kind of vintage gear and you get on AM, you just absolutely have to have it. So, yeah, we'll do that. We've got a lot of things coming. I'm looking at doing that grounding show. We've got to have Steve on here. Tintec's going to be on with a new rig. They contacted me, the guys from Rebel, their new little box. They want to talk about that. And then, of course, this has been really kicking around for some time, and I've been so lax in getting this happening, but we're going to have the master on that owns Vibroplex, and we'll have a little show about CW and what to do with. Of course, he is going to laugh at me with my J38, but that's the way it is. Anyway, these are all shows coming up. Don't miss any of them because they're all really great. I will see you in good old Oklahoma, going down to the Ham Holiday, making a couple of stops to play a couple of fabulous Wurlitzers in Miami, Oklahoma tomorrow morning, and Tulsa, Oklahoma tomorrow afternoon. Got some nice Robert Morton and Wurlitzer things happening there. So we'll make some music on the way to Oak City. So 7-3, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks to Leo Laporte to putting this together. And as you saw earlier on the show before this, it all happened at the college. It was his idea to put Ham Nation together, and here we are. And we're having a lot of fun bringing you this great excitement and knowledge of ham radio. We'll talk to you next week right here on the Twit Network. And I say 7-3 for now. We'll talk to you on the radio, either on 40 or 75 after the Nets. And George, what are the dewdrops in D-Star?
Well, I've got all the nets here, Bob. I noticed on 40 meters, they're going to be on 72, 78 tonight. 20 meters will be on 14.268, their normal frequency. Echo Link will be on star, do drop in star, or node number 355-800. And as always, the D-Star Net will be on reflector 14, module C, 73.
Okay, great. All right, let her go, Gordo. Are you hearing the guys on 40 out there yet?
I am. I'm on 40, 72, 78, and I know 20 is coming in as well.
Okay. Well, we'll get to talk to Bill Sepulveda. All right, 73, everybody. This is K9EID. Bye-bye for now.